From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are watching Hurricane Joaquin bearing down on the Bahamas and maybe soon the east coast of the United States. It is a Category 3 storm right now, but some are preparing for the storm to strengthen.
Okay, so we're going to hear a lot more about that. But also today, Russia launched new airstrikes in Syria. Yesterday, they said the strikes were only attacking ISIS militants. But today, a spokesperson for Russian President Vladimir Putin admitted that Russia's airstrikes in Syria are targeting not only ISIS militants, but also other groups not affiliated with ISIS who oppose President Bashar al-Assad, who, of course, is supported by Russia and not by Syrian rebels or the U.S. Here's Republican Senator John McCain on CNN today.
I can absolutely confirm to you that they were strikes against our Free Syrian Army or groups that have been armed and trained by the CIA, because we have communications with people there.
Jim Walsh is Here and Now security analyst and with MIT Security Studies Program. So he has communications, but we also have this Russian spokesperson saying this. You say what?
Well, I say it's hard to hide an airstrike. You know, it's going to show up when you do it. And Syria actually, as conflict zones go, has a lot of monitors, a lot of people who are reporting in independent websites. And if you looked at how the Russians were organizing their forces, they were organizing them in a way that led you to believe that that's where they would be used.
Yeah, well, so I chuckled, but not because this is funny. Obviously, this is very serious.
Yes.
We could see the results if these tapes are purporting to show the results are true. You know, people are under rubble on the ground. But what happens now? You know, the U.S. can't give anti-aircraft equipment to the rebels that the U.S. supports to shoot at the Soviet planes.
I mean, I think people in Congress will push for that. I think the U.S. is going to be reluctant to do that for fear that those weapons will fall into others' hands, as we've seen
also,
in this conflict.
Well, also, it will draw the U.S. and the Russians more into a conflict.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's going to get more complicated here, but so far this is the way it's divided up, and you can almost see a certain logic to it. The Brits, the French are attacking ISIS. In some ways, that frees Russia to focus on Assad's other threat, which is the Free Syrian Army. You know, both the Free Syrian Army and the extremists are battling Assad. We're attacking one now. He's going to take the opportunity to attack the other. But let me underline, I think the reason why we're seeing this now, the big picture here, is that Assad is losing. You know, he's lost 80% of the territory that used to be Syria in strategic retreat, lack of manpower, boots on the ground from his own sources. And so it makes sense that the Russians are trying to step in to save their ally.
Can they?
You know, if you're sitting in Moscow, this looks like, well, this could have certain tactical advantages. It could improve our bargaining leverage. It makes people stop talking about Crimea. Better to fight them there than in the Caucasus. But I think if you step back, this seems like a really bad idea. If you're Russia, what you're essentially saying is, I'm a foreign power. I'm going to now go into a fractured Arab country, defend a dictator who is guilty of war crimes and does not have the popular support of the people in the country. And how does that end exactly? What's stage 2 and 3 look like? I think that needs to be thought through for the Russians.
Well, but you know that one of the ways people are increasingly saying it ends from all across the political spectrum is that the U.S. has got to admit that maybe Assad stays because there's no one right now to replace him.
You know, I am just deeply skeptical about this idea. Here's why. Let's say you get some political agreement that's negotiated in Geneva or Vienna. Does that mean ISIL is going to stop fighting? Does it mean Turkey is going to stop supporting the rebels in Syria? Saudi Arabia is going to do that? These guys aren't going to quit just because diplomats in a European city come up with an agreement. I think, you know, I don't see how it ends, frankly.
Well, is a third possible way that the Russians maybe come to their senses in your point of view and instead do what they said they were doing, which is attack ISIS along with the coalition, France, Britain, largely the U.S., and maybe the rebels do get to exist, but so does Assad.
Yeah, I guess. I guess that's a pretty tall order. I don't see that happening anytime soon. All I know is, if I'm Russia, I'm pouring more troops and material in. I'm going to kill a lot more Arabs. I think there's probably going to be consequences to that.
Yeah, for the Russians.
For the Russians.
And meanwhile, if you were the U.S., I know you have channels.
Yes.
What are they saying at the Obama White House?
Well, you know, I just had a meeting with President Rouhani when he was in town for the UN General Assembly. He talked almost exclusively about Syria. Yes, of Iran. And we talked exclusively about Syria. And his notion was, well, we have to have priorities. The first priority is to get rid of ISIL, ISIS. And then we'll talk about reforming the Syrian government. That's code word for dealing with Assad that no one actually likes. Even his allies don't like him. But I don't think the U.S. can stomach a policy where we just the first thing we do is we kill all these ISIL people and then at the very end begin to address Assad's position, because he'll already be secure by that point. I just don't see how these positions add up.
Security analyst Jim Walsh, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the state of New Jersey has declared a state of emergency today in preparation for a possible hit from Hurricane Joaquin. We'll be tracking it over the next several days. But let's go to where the storm is right now in the Bahamas. Joining us from Nassau is Captain Stephen Russell, director of the Bahamas National Emergency Management Agency. And Captain, what is the latest as you're looking at it? What are you expecting from this storm?
A number of our islands in the southeastern Bahamas, they are experiencing the brunt of the storm as we speak. We're getting reports from persons in those areas, extensive flooding in the areas, and of course the high winds from this particular system. So we're urging all persons at this time just to remain safe wherever they are, trying to remain safe. We don't want anybody venturing out in the storm or the hurricane at this time.
What is the biggest threat right now? Is it just a lot of rain?
It's a lot of rain. It's been compounded by, we had the spring tides, the high tides as a result of the moon, the full moon, and all of our islands are low-lying areas. So they've been having extensive flooding even before the storm really approached the islands, just from the spring tides. So we're urging our persons to remain safe and try to turn off electrical powers in their vicinity just to avoid any fatalities or injuries from electricity and water mixture.
And will there be any evacuations, or is it just at this point time for people to just hunker down?
At this point, it's too late for any evacuations. We have our shelters were open in all of our family islands as of 6 p.m. yesterday.
Are there any tourists there right now, or is it mostly have they all left in advance of the storm?
In the islands, in the southeastern Bahamas, we once the storms approach, we encourage persons and visitors to leave those islands. But in terms of New Providence, we have not order. New Providence, Grand Bahama, Abaco, or Luther, we have not ordered any evacuation of tourists at this time, based on the projections of the storm that we have been seeing.
How many hurricanes have you been through, Captain Russell?
Well, I've been with the disaster program from 1992, Hurricane Andrew, so all of the storms over the past 23 years.
And how does this one compare to the other ones you've seen?
I've seen Hurricane Andrew, a Category 4 or 5. I've seen Francis, Wilma, Jane, all of those. This one, I would place it almost in that group with Hurricane Andrew and some of the others.
Hmm.
Not until we can really do a thorough assessment, and then we can really place it among the that group of storms that I've seen over the past two decades.
All right, Captain Russell. Well, thank you so much, and best of luck with the storm.
Good. Thank you so much.
That's Captain Stephen Russell, director of the Bahamas National Emergency Management Agency, speaking with us from Nassau in the Bahamas. And we also reached out to Kwanzaa Bo, co-owner of Chat and Chill Restaurant in Great Exuma in the Bahamas. We reached her at her home where she doesn't have power, and we asked her how she's preparing for the storm.
Well, we are right now in the process of putting up our hurricane shutters. We're pretty much mostly prepared because we usually keep, some canned items on site, but we don't think it's going to hit directly. We think it'll be out to the east of us, but God forbid, we'll be prepared.
But you're not planning to evacuate?
No. We live live on the beach, but we're on a little hill from the beach, and there's some outlying protective keys, so it breaks the current, from coming all the way here.
Do you feel like the Bahamas are pretty well equipped to handle a big hurricane, that the buildings are built up to a standard that there shouldn't be an incredible amount of damage, even from a Category 3 storm?
Yes, that's correct. The house where, you know, I currently dwell is my husband's family home, and it was built in 1963, and it survived a Category 4 hurricane back in 89, was it? Like 89. So, you know, it's all poured concrete walls, you know, so it was built for this type of thing.
So what's the mood, basically, where you are right now? Are people all feeling pretty stoic as this hurricane approaches?
Yeah, we've been in touch with our friends on Facebook, our customers. We're all praying that it makes a turn to go quickly out into the ocean. But, you know, you never can tell with these things. I mean, Tuesday we heard there was a storm, and Wednesday when we woke up, we were in hurricane warning. So that just developed out of nowhere. So you never can tell with these things.
All right, Kwanzaa. Well, best of luck to you as this storm approaches. Kwanzaa Bowe, co-owner of Chat and Chill Restaurant in Great Exuma in the Bahamas. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have a great day.
And again, after Joaquin passes by the Bahamas, it is expected to come up the East Coast. The question is whether it's going to hit the United States or head on out to sea. We'll be watching right here, here and now.
We've been hearing a lot lately about the mind-body connection. Today, the effect of spirituality on children. Columbia University psychologist Lisa Miller says it is essential for healthy brain growth and a thriving child. And what's more, when spirituality is stunted, say by parents who feel uncomfortable because they don't have answers to kids' curious questions, it can stunt growth, just like not doing math can limit our ability to do math. She also says there's a surge of spirituality in adolescence that often reads as risky behavior.
Let's hear it for Lisa Miller and Robin Young.
Lisa Miller's new book is The Spiritual Child, The New Science of Parenting for Health and Lifelong Thriving. Last week, we sat down at Temple Beth Elohim in Wellesley, Massachusetts, on Yom Kippur, a somber day of atonement. Congregants had been fasting all day, and I jokingly told them they'd applaud anything we said because they were dizzy with hunger, but they were hungry for answers. Lisa began by defining spirituality as a personal relationship to a higher power, even nature, as opposed to religion, which is a belief system. You can have spirituality in religion and without it. Here's Lisa Miller.
So this is a very important point. I'll start with the science. If you put people into an MRI, you find that those who have a sustained personal relationship with God in the way that we've been discussing it have a thicker cortex in the parietal and occipital regions, the same regions that would be thin in people with recurrent major depression. That is a finding published in JAMA about a year ago that says that the same regions that are thin with recurrent depression are thick if there's a strong spiritual life. The way to spiritually based life can happen in a sense of oneness. It can happen in our rich indigenous traditions in a sense of spirit and in through living beings. But it is reaching that same deep, heritable capacity for relationship to God or the universe.
This is why you are very much against tribal spirituality, this idea of our God is the best God. You actually encourage people to have their children.
Multilingualism, very important. The child is born naturally spiritually alive and inquiring and eager to run into this synagogue and that mosque and this church and that graveyard.
You say go with them.
Go with them. By the time a child is six, without that introduction to the spirit, many spiritual expressions of the world, at age six, Azar and Banaji's team at Harvard showed that a child is more likely to say that their family's name for God is more real than the name of God used by the family down the street of another faith tradition. And they are more likely to share their peanut butter sandwich with the child who uses this home-based name for God than that other name for God. And now we have a world on fire because people can't agree with the symbolism that we give to God.
So you're saying they're born with this innate acceptance and then that something happens and changes it.
But we can teach a child to hear of the redemption, the birth of spring, a new child's life. Spiritual events can be heard through the language of four different faith traditions in kindergarten, and the child can become multilingual. They still have their home religion.
Well, this leads you to spirituality should be taught more in schools. Multilingual spiritualism. The columnist David Brooks in the New York Times picked this up and pushed for it. But, you know, the concern is that it will become teaching dogma, teaching ideology. How do you convince someone who's afraid of having spirituality in school that it won't become that?
Well, the child is spiritually alive whether or not we acknowledge it. Now, it doesn't mean that in a public school we speak only about one religion. I think a class in which we look at many faith traditions and welcome the child to speak in the first person about their own personal spiritual life is a way of acknowledging spirituality in our human condition.
And you'd have to include the child who doesn't feel that there is God. I mean, it would have to be that broad.
And in fact, there's data on that. About 20% of people are virtuous humanists, for whom the deepest meaning comes in the space between people. And they are every bit as much associated with a virtuous life. To omit that from our discussions is to leave a big gaping hole in the center of civilization.
You make the point several times that little children have this feeling of spirituality, and as they grow older, preteens, and I remembered mine. Mm. And I wonder if people, you know, everyone here might think back, do you remember having a moment and you just feel one with everything? I was walking through a cornfield. I'm from Long Island, but I was walking through this cornfield, and I mean, pillar of salt. I just felt the best I've ever felt in my life in a cornfield.
How old were you?
I was about 11.
So right around the time of puberty, there is spiritual awakening. It's tied into biological spiritual awakening. Most cultures on Earth show this in their traditions, that coming-of-age ceremonies are intertwined with augmented spiritual awareness. There's a hunger to know, what is my meaning? What is the purpose? What is the meaning, the purpose? And a hunger of the heart to feel transcendence.
And there are late nights moaning and groaning about a Fred who hasn't called, or driving a car too fast. I mean, a lot of teenage behavior that we either roll our eyes at or get angry about is this surge.
Unmidwifed spiritual awakening. So spiritual awakening happens from the inside out, and we can show up and guide that towards an integrated view of what is my purpose on earth, what is my contribution, how do I pray, how do I connect with God, or we can let it go willy-nilly, and that's where we get drunken driving, that's where we get jumping off a bridge, that's where we get risk-taking as a way to feel and transcend.
So what should parents do? Let's go back to children. You say that not only can and should parents nurture, but they can do the opposite. Give me an example of how a parent might react in those, what we now see as spiritual moments.
So in the most tongue-tied, unsure moment, we can simply show up, right? And there are many people who don't want to say the wrong thing or impose their half-baked beliefs on their child, but to simply show up and think of the child as a knower. You know, their question rarely is seeking a direct answer. It's actually saying that they're onto something. So we can sit by their side and see where they take us. Because shutting down the child takes away the opportunity for the child to step forward.
So when you have a child, you don't have to know the answers. You just have to let them do the exploration. Teenage years. Mm. And they have come home drunk, or they have tried drugs. Where is the spiritual conversation there?
I have spoken to so many young adults who said, all I wanted was for someone to say, you know, in this late night drinking, where is your deep personal meaning? I had a fellow come to me who was addicted to pornography. He was the golden boy of his town. He was class president, all the while feeling dirty and bad and hidden. He said, all I wanted was at 16 for someone to say, where in your relationship with women, with girls, is your spirituality? He wanted someone to help him put it all together. Mm-hmm. But by leaving spirituality out of adolescent development, we have an empty train run wild, and then we have a withering spirituality over here.
You point out that often what they're trying to do is find that same feeling. Smoking marijuana, well, it made me feel so mellow, and it made me feel good, like I felt when I was in that forest with the stars when we were camping. There is a correlation for them.
There's a very, science supports that very strongly. The one reason that I hear most frequently cited by parents that we don't pursue spiritual life is that we're too busy, right? So the race to travel soccer and the race to cello lessons and the extra math. But actually, it turns out that there's nothing as predictive of thriving and even outward success as a strong inner life.
Two things. You can have spirituality without religion.
Yes.
And religion can be a negative if it's rigid religiosity.
So there are studies that show the power in religion comes in shaping the deep natural spirituality of the child, how a child talks directly to Hashem, the higher power, whatever tradition the child's raised in. But there are cases in which a rigid adherence that does not allow for the child to essentially breathe into it, to question.
That can actually lead a child to have more dangerous risk-taking behavior.
Yes, that loses its protective benefits. The personal relationship to the higher power, that has been shown in adolescence to be 60% protective against severe depression, 80% protective against dangerous risk-taking. There is nothing in the clinical or medical sciences as profoundly protective against the most common forms of suffering in the second decade as a strong personal spiritual life.
Psychologist and author Lisa Miller, and again, she told the congregation at Beth Elohim Temple that a strong spiritual life in children can be through an organized religion or not. We'll leave you with this story.
I met a young Cherokee woman, actually, at a healing ceremony in the West, and she said, you know, I was raised by my grandma. My mom was an addict, and my grandma, she just loved me. And I sat at the kitchen table. We'd talk night after night. And when my grandma died, I had nobody. So I want you to know. So she's telling us, so that I'll tell you, that I would climb up into a tree. There was a great, great tree. And that tree was a place of peace. And I want you to know that tree raised me. So it doesn't take a rat race to make a child who's fulfilled. It takes actually sitting by their side and cultivating a spiritual life.
Columbia University psychologist Lisa Miller, her book, The Spiritual Child, at Beth Elohim Temple in Wellesley, Massachusetts, which, by the way, has a resident composer, Noah Aronson, who right after we spoke sang a song using our words. We'll post the entire song at hereandnow.org.
Days pass and the years vanish, and we walk sightless among miracles. God, fill our eyes with seeing and our minds with knowing. Let there be moments when your presence like lightning.
A new court ruling has thrown a new wrench into the debate over paying college athletes. Now, according to the ruling body, the NCAA, athletes, especially football and basketball players, are technically amateurs who can't be paid aside from scholarships. Now, a district court had ruled that they could be paid, that schools could pay athletes as much as $5,000 a year for the use of their names and likenesses. But yesterday, a federal appeals court rejected that lower court ruling. But the appeals court ruling was mixed. The court also agreed that the NCAA had violated antitrust rules by restricting players' ability to trade on their images and likenesses. What? Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, square this for us. The court says you can't pay them $5,000, but the NCAA is violating antitrust laws by not paying them.
Right. I'll take you through it. So last year, last August, the players got a really big win, maybe even bigger than they thought. They won the initial suit and they were, as you said, allowed to be paid $5,000. But this new court said didn't overturn the suit. The suit is still won. But they questioned, you know, where'd that first judge get the $5,000 figure? They said they can be paid up to compensated for the cost of attending college. By the way, we all think, oh, yeah, athletes get a full scholarship. They're compensated for the cost of attending. They're not compensated for the cost of attending. There's usually a gap between what they get paid and the actual cost of attending. So things like, you know, your travel to and from home, things like that, weren't paid. So even this ruling, even though it's been overturned, athletes are getting a little more in their pocket. It's that extra $5,000 that this court says, yeah, that's not really, that's not appropriate.
Well, so what do you think happens if they're just questioning where'd you get that amount? Are they saying, I mean, again, to be clear for those of us on the fringe of this, are they saying athletes can be paid? Or it sounds like you're saying only the cost of going to school.
Right now, that's true. There are a lot of other courts wending their way through the courts, sorry, a lot of other cases.
Right.
And it seems to me that the idea of amateurism as a justification for not paying or for paying less than they need to or for offering no compensation for name, image, and likeness, that idea, that amateurism excuse has been thrown out the window. The court, I think, is just saying, come up with a justification for how much you should be paid. But so what the court has essentially said is the NCAA argues that the value is zero. The court says it's not zero. There's definitely a worth to the fact that you're making billions of dollars by putting on television the NCAA basketball tournament and college bowl games. So it's worth something, but you got to come up with a better number. Why? It all came from a famous player, the best player in the 1995 tournament, Ed O'Bannon. He was watching a video game, and it was clearly him. They didn't use the name O'Bannon, but it was his number, and the guy in the video game acted like him, and that's why he started the lawsuit. So this is, in general, the trends are good for the athletes, even though this $5,000, by the way, which hasn't been instituted, it wasn't going to be instituted into 2016. So not one extra dollar has been taken out of an athlete's pocket. So it would seem like they need to do a little more research on how to compensate the players. But the players maybe will be compensated.
Well, and put the money in the athlete's pocket. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. We will continue to follow this. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Alfredo Prieto is scheduled to die today in Virginia. His execution, one of six originally scheduled to take place in this country over a span of 9 days. One of those was halted yesterday when Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon issued a 37-day stay on the execution of Richard Glossop to address questions about the state's execution protocols. On Tuesday in Georgia, Kelly Gissendonner became one of the small list of women ever to be executed in the U.S. Joining us now is Robert Dunham, the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. And Robert Dunham, Kelly Gissendonner was the 21st execution of 2015 in the U.S. Is that a greater number of executions for this point in the year?
No, that's actually less than one typically has. But there's been a pattern in the United States towards reduced use of the death penalty, and that's been reflected both in sentences imposed and executions carried out. So last year there were 35, which was a 20-year low. If all the ones that are scheduled for the rest of this year are carried out, we'll be between 35 and 40. So that is continuing an historical trend of fewer executions.
Because of attitudes about the death penalty or because of the difficulty of getting the drugs needed to carry it out?
Well, delays, you can attribute some delays to the difficulty in getting drugs, but the drop in the number of executions, I think, is a product of reduced support for the death penalty and the fact that in many of the cases, courts are paying closer attention to the problems that have occurred. These six exemplify a number of very serious problems with the death penalty in the United States.
When you say reduced support, what are we talking about? What do the polls say about how Americans feel about the death penalty?
Well, in the late 1980s, going into the early 90s, the Gallup polls were saying that support for the death penalty was at about 80%. The most recent poll by the Pew Research Council showed that support for the death penalty, if you ask the question in the abstract, was 56%. So that's more than a 20 percentage point drop. And when you ask the follow-up question, the policy question, which do you think is the preferable punishment for murder? Is it life without parole or death? More Americans now say that life without parole is a more appropriate punishment than the death penalty.
There are 31 states with the death penalty today. Where are executions most common?
There are a core set of states that are responsible for most of the executions. Texas has executed by far the most. In fact, it's executed more than any other six states combined. Missouri has been executing a lot of people recently, Oklahoma as well. Other states that historically have executed a lot of people are Virginia and Oklahoma, all of whom have people who are scheduled to be executed in the next week.
And why do those states have so many more executions than other states?
Well, that's a contentious issue. They certainly have more aggressive death penalty practices, but there also is a sense in which there is reduced access to judicial review in those states. So states like Texas and Virginia in particular, which have executed the highest percentage of their death row inmates, had very strict rules of procedural default, which meant that if you were poorly represented and a lawyer failed to raise an issue at the appropriate time, you would never get to have that issue heard. So in states that gave less review to a case, you would have a higher rate of execution. There also is a cultural tradition, if you will. Texas and Virginia and the states in the South had a long history of using punishment to reinforce the social structure. And what I mean by that is there is a lot of literature about the death penalty being an extension of slavery and an extension of Jim Crow. And when you take a look at these states and you see the vast majority of people who are sentenced to death and have the death sentences actually carried out killed white victims, you begin to understand. And when you see the level of representation and the poverty for the defendants who are facing the death penalty, you begin to understand the relationship between race and economics and the culture of violence in those states. So there are states that historically have been associated with violence, with higher rates of lynching, and with heavier use of the death penalty. They're the ones that provide, in general, poorer representation and provide less access to the courts.
Although I imagine that if you were to ask a state official in Texas about what you just said, they would say, of course, there's no connection between slavery or even racism and the people that were putting to death who have been convicted of serious crimes.
Oh, I'm sure that's what they would say. It's very hard to say that there is a direct relationship between the two. But what you're talking about are well-established social structures and the law enforcement attitudes that come from that, the opportunities, the social opportunities that come from that, and the choices that are made as to who you're going to proceed capitally against or whether you're going to proceed capitally. In a number of the jurisdictions that used to impose the death penalty the most, when they changed prosecutors, the practices significantly changed. Mm. So in Harris County, Houston, which has put more people to death than any other county in the United States, when there was a change in prosecutors about a decade ago, the rate of death sentencing began to drop. And Harris is a really interesting example both of the social dynamics and of the value of quality representation. In Harris County in the 90s, again, as in the United States, about 80% of the public said they supported the death penalty. And there was very poor representation. There wasn't an indigent defense system in place. Texas has, since that time, adopted life without parole as an option, and the jury is told about that. It has a regional indigent defense system for capital cases. The quality of representation has improved, and Harris County has become much more heterogeneous. It is in the process of becoming a majority-minority county.
Right.
Support for the death penalty now there is also down to the same levels as nationwide. And when you ask Harris County residents what the appropriate punishment for murder is, only 28% of them now say the death penalty, and there have been no death sentences imposed in Houston this year.
What about the nightmare scenario that somebody is put to death who it turns out didn't do anything wrong to begin with? How many cases do we know about of that situation, whether they actually are put to death or whether they're on death row and then it turns out because of DNA evidence or whatever that they were innocent?
Well, we know that there have been 155 people who were sentenced to death who have subsequently been exonerated. There are also a number of cases that we know of in Texas and elsewhere where people who were almost certainly innocent have been executed. Richard Glossop is the most recent case where there is very serious evidence that suggests that he was not involved in the murder at all. And, of course, Troy Davis in Georgia 4 years ago was another example where 7 out of 9 witnesses recanted saying they'd been pressured into falsely implicating him. And there have been a number of exonerations in the last 2 years, and most disturbingly about them, in 12 of the last 13 death row exonerations, the person went to death row primarily as a product of prosecutorial or police misconduct.
Robert Dunham, do you think if we had this conversation 10 years from now, there would still be the death penalty in practice in the United States?
I think if we had the conversation 10 years from now, it would be a very different discussion. It looks as though major efforts at abolition are going forward. Justice Breyer, in his dissenting opinion in the lethal injection case, Glossop versus Gross, invited defense lawyers to mount legal challenges to the constitutionality of the death penalty. The legal doctrine that it's based on is something called the evolving standards of decency, where the justices look at what the state-by-state and county-by-county practices are. And depending on what develops over the next couple of years, the court could say that the death penalty is unconstitutional and has been rejected by American society. Hmm. On the other hand, one can very well imagine a possibility that if the composition of the court changes, that there are not sufficient votes to do away with the death penalty. So I could very easily see 10 years from now or 15 years from now a country without the death penalty, but that is not a certainty.
That's Robert Dunham, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. That's a nonprofit organization that studies the death penalty in the U.S. Robert Dunham, thank you.
Thank you.
And let us know where you stand on the death penalty. You can do that at hereandnow.org, or you can send us a tweet at Jeremy Hobson, at Here and Now Robin, at Here and Now.
Some news this week in the world of TV, and it involves Nicki Minaj, who's more likely to be doing this. Let's go get it down. The sound, yes, I'm in the zone. Is it 2, 3? Leave a good tip. I'ma blow all of my money and don't give two. I'm on the floor. Pop artist Nicki Minaj is going to be taking her talents to television, ABC announced this week. The singer and rapper is going to executive produce and appear in a scripted comedy series on ABC Family. Joining us to talk about that and some other shows coming back this weekend, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, Nicki Minaj is a huge pop star. She's also had some very explicit rap. So start with the ABC Family part of this.
Is there going to be a lot of bleeping? Is that what you're asking me?
Well, she cursed at Miley Cyrus at the MTV Video Music Awards.
She's cursed at everybody. If you watched American Idol, she cursed at Mariah Carey when they were both judges. Well, first of all, let's establish that ABC Family is not a children's channel. Mm-hmm. One of its most buzzed about shows is called The Fosters, which is about a lesbian couple that is raising a bunch of foster kids. Mm-hmm. And often they talk about subjects that might be considered more grown up. So ABC Family is a channel that has always been aging up its material. So I think this show is going to be something that will not be afraid to talk about maybe some of the more challenging aspects of her history. But it's also going to be a show where it's not going to be as explicit as maybe her raps are. But they're not necessarily going to shy away from important subjects and edgy subjects, because there are already other shows on that channel that do that.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to think. There are plenty of examples of artists that have gone the other way, you know, from TV to pop star fame. Mostly Mouseketeers, you know. But I'm trying to think of anybody who's gone from pop star to TV star.
Well, I guess if you want to think about the show itself that they're going to create, the nearest comparison might be Everybody Hates Chris, which is the comedy that Chris Rock did that was sort of based on his life. I suspect that this show was also inspired by the success of Empire, which was a fictional show about a hip-hop star family and the company that he's running. I suspect what we're going to see is a coming-of-age story for a hip-hop artist, which is frankly something we've never really seen on television, and certainly not a female rapper. So I think this could be really interesting ground if they do it right, sort of a combination of Everybody Hates Chris and Empire.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a couple of other returns to TV. The Affair, which comes back for season 2 on Showtime on Sunday night. This is a show that tries to play off the idea that there are a bunch of different versions of the truth. What's new about this season?
The first season of the show, for people who watched it, was the story of an affair told from the perspectives of two different people, the guy who cheats on his wife and the woman that he cheats with who is also in a marriage that's failing. This season, it's going to be from the perspectives of four people. So those two people, the guy who cheats on his wife and his mistress, and also the jilted husband and the jilted wife. And this gets to be a little complicated sometimes. And I was in Los Angeles over the summer, and I talked to Ruth Wilson, who plays Allison, the woman who is the mistress in this relationship. And she talked a little bit about the fine line that the show has to walk between showing different perspectives, but also telling a full story that the audience can understand that there's some central truth there. Let's check out the clip.
Mm-hmm. But if it does get pushed too far, then people will question the reliability of the show itself. And you have to be very subtle. I've walked that subtle line, because if you can't trust any of the information that's been fed to you, or it's so diverse, then where do you sit as an audience?
Exactly. You know, the idea of the show initially seemed to be that you see things from two different people's perspectives. And as the audience member, you're the referee and you sort of get a sense of, OK, here's where the middle is. And that's an unusual tack for a show to take that is trying to tell a story that draws in people who want to know. Ultimately, at the heart of this show is a question of how a character got killed. And there's a murder investigation, and the guy who cheated on his wife is arrested for the crime. So it will be interesting to see how they balance all this different stuff in a very complex show.
Speaking of objective truth and complex shows, just briefly touch on the fact that this Sunday we also see the return of Homeland to Showtime, Season 5. It stars Claire Danes as a CIA agent with bipolar disorder. Now, critics seem to think it started off strong but then tailed off. Your thoughts going into Season 5?
Well, what's been interesting about Homeland is it's a show that's changed a lot. It started out being the story of two different characters, Claire Danes' character, who's a bipolar CIA officer, and Damian Lewis's character, who was this soldier who had been brainwashed by his captors in the Middle East. But they kept his character around too long, and the show's had to recover from that. Now, it's a very compelling drama about circumstances that could exist in the real world in terms of espionage and terrorism in the Middle East. I think the show is getting closer and closer to real life and not having a situation that feels so unusual or outlandish. Now we are talking about things that intelligence officers are grappling with in the real world right now.
So maybe you don't have to binge watch. You can just tune in. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
Robin, was that a reference to me? Because you know I've been binge-watching Homeland for the last couple of weeks.
I know. Are you okay?
I'm up to halfway through Season 3, and it is a lot of fun.
We just told you what happened.
I wasn't listening very closely.
As usual. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.